Welcome to Passion to Power with your host, Michelle Zeitlin. She's a creative producer who quote-unquote wears many hats. She's also a talent and literary manager and founded the company More Zap Productions and Management. She develops people and projects across all media. Her guests encompass the gamut, from artists to authors, actors to activists. Please welcome Michelle Zeitlin, Passion to Power.
My name is Farah Ramzan-Golant.
Farah, I'm so thrilled to have you on my show, Passion to Power. And I'm excited to tell you that since you're in England, we have several listeners in the UK across the pond. I'm in LA, and we love to rhyme. I would love to hear a bit about your background and the diversity of cultures you come from and how that has benefited your work for the company you work for, Q, and maybe then you can broaden our understanding of what that company is and does.
Thank you, Michelle. Well, it's lovely to talk to you, and I'm excited to share my story. Thank you for being interested. You ask about sort of the beginning and the origins and where I come from. So I think it's fair to say that the very beginning of my journey was my birth in Africa. I was born in Nairobi to a awesome mum and dad. My mother has had a stellar career in education, working with Down syndrome, children with Down syndrome across Africa. And my father, an entrepreneur, businessman. So I think from the beginning, Indian-Iranian family, born in Africa, one very engaged in purpose-led work with Downs and one very entrepreneurial, commercially driven guy. So I think from the beginning, I've had purpose and profit as a polarity in my system. And then we've continued to be a pretty nomadic family. We came to England when I was five, so I am technically a first generation immigrant. I went to Cambridge and did a degree in modern and medieval languages. Yes, I did medieval languages because that was going to sort out my life. Not really. And then married a guy who's half American, half Canadian, from a really beautiful academic family. He's an academic, a business school academic. And we have two lovely children, Ishtar and Zach, who were both born in London and both think passionately of the Arsenal Football Club as their true religion. So I guess all of this to say that we've come from a cultural melting pot spanning Africa, India, Europe, the Americas. And what I think it's given me and in my forward motion through life is a sense of always looking for possibility and optimism. Farah, my name, is Arabic for joy. And I think it's given me in my DNA character a lust for the possible, the creative, the what ifs, and a lust for change and experimentation.
Beautifully stated. I love that. A lust for the possible. So we have several P's in our different expressions and experience, right? I'm passion to power. You have purpose. You have the possible. I love it. So you work now for a company called Q, which is, as I understand, a Japanese holding company. Could you outline what the company does and what you do for Q?
So Q is really an extraordinary collective. It's headquartered in New York. Our shareholders are Japanese. So it's a strategic unit of HDY Holdings. So our shareholders are Japanese. The company itself is American. And it is founded on the principle of unleashing creativity as a very precious resource on the planet. And the purpose of Q, which was set up by a lovely man called Michael Birkin 6 years ago, was to think about creativity and this as a source that springs from a human source, but creativity designed to propel the economy and society forwards. And therein a great twin tracking between purpose and commercial return. How do you impact the economy and grow it and shape it, but also how do you measure and believe in your societal impact? And it's a fantastic company. It's not called a company, it's a collective. So it's organized in a very different 21st century way. There are 10 companies in the collective, which are incredible, one of a kind, marquee firms, I would say, IDEO, SYP, Sidley. I know you know my friend Andy Bateman from Sidley, Atelier in Istanbul, Public Digital in Britain, Behavioral Economics Group called BE Works in Canada. And these companies really have come into the collective. We think of them as members, member companies of the collective. The collective is organized around a council. I think what makes this collective so unique and distinctive is that it's really organized around how does a collective behave and organize itself? How do we put an accent on cultures, rituals that enable creativity? It indexes highly on belief systems. You know, how do you create a sense of community of communities? How do you develop trust, reciprocity, belonging inside the collective? Because as you build as human beings gravitate to trust, reciprocity, and a sense of belonging, they do their great. And we have a strong sense of affiliation with communities, partners, so that we're a very fluid, porous collective. And we're like little magpies constantly seeking out people like us to be part of a sort of, you know, where. And I often like to say, slightly facetiously, that it's where really talented rebels like to gather. It's by no means perfect, you know, we are learning as we go. But what it's done is assemble in a way, it's like a, you know, it's assembled its Avengers, its Rebel Alliance. It's a tight-knit group of 10 companies. We acquire companies very selectively, and always they have to bring something distinctive, a distinctive edge. But what binds us together is this notion of how do you push the boundaries of creativity? How do you collaborate? How do you combine? How do you hold big questions? And how do you impact every strata of the world, whether it's brands and how you serve brands, whether it's companies and corporations, in our case, also governments, we work with governments. How do you help governments see their citizens differently? Our clients are both brands, corporations, governments, and citizens, because the status quo ossifies us, makes us concrete, makes us fixed. And of course, what we know is that the world is very fluid, it's constantly moving, it's dynamic. So I think I rebel, definitely I in my private life have been a rebel. I mean, you know, I came from a lovely Muslim family, I married a guy from a Jewish family. Between us, we managed to woo and seduce our respective communities, you know, to enable our marriage, to enable our children. But rebelling against the status quo and rebelling against the notion of stasis and complacency and growth can only come from the old way of thinking. So a rebel against a mindset that says we have to do it the way we've done it for 2000 years. And I have the kind of, you know, curiosity that says, what if we actually didn't accept those rules?
So how does that approach give you permission on the daily to do what you do? Because those are very broad comments and, you know, bold stakes to hold. And like you say, a very dynamic paradigm to live by and work by. But how do you do that on the daily?
Well, on the daily, it's always after a really freshly ground cup of cappuccino. I think of my work or my contribution at three levels. The way that I work at Q. So at one level, working with the companies in our collective, I think of myself as a bit of an idea spotter, and that I can roam in the collective. I mean, obviously our companies do amazing work, they're self-sufficient, they're incredibly dynamic, but I am very good at spotting the possibility for iconic ideas that require epic collaboration. So it's constantly looking at Gottfried Adage partners in the West Coast, working on the new editorial. Sid Lee are thinking about reshaping the future of brands. So at one level, it's working with the companies through infiltration, through just being interesting and provocative, to spot the iconic ideas and to say, how can we hot house them? How can we accelerate them? How can we invest in the idea? How can we bring a bigger, broader set of disciplines to the idea? And then how can we make the idea valuable out in the world? So that's one thing. I'd call that my idea spotting role. At a second level, we also are constantly looking for one-of-a-kind companies to join the collective. Very selectively, but I'm constantly out there in the world meeting new enterprises that represent amazing disciplines. I mean, we have such a broad sweep of disciplines from architecture to behavioral economics. But my second thing is meeting companies and trying to understand what their dream is and trying to understand what might happen to them if they joined the Q platform and how much further and faster they could fly. So that's my sort of finding the new rebels to join the alliance. And then at the third level, to think at the collective, because I work at Q at the sort of corporate center, though the word corporate is terrible, at the collective center, is to think about the products and services and the things we might do to enable our member companies to do better than they would on their own. So some of the things that I've done in my time is to develop a thing called the Q Graph, which is a data visualization system. It's absolutely beautiful. It's like, imagine a constellation of all these planets in different shapes and sizes, but we've created now through a data visualization system, an ability for anyone at Q to come into the universe, to see themselves, to see all our disciplines, all our people, all our clients and projects, all our passions. So if I'm somebody at IDEO London and I want to collaborate with a Europe-based footprint, I can look into Kepler Infectious Media, I can look into Public Digital, and I can find like-minded people with the skill sets so that collaboration can be very quick and very frictionless because it's a way to find like-minded people. So that's the Q Graph. It's one of the things we've done. It's also to think about central strategy. How do we develop our communities? How do we convene? In January, in the dark days of January, we attempted a virtual convening of all 2,500 people in the collective, wow, virtually, through a platform that we built called Kin. And we said, well, it's dark, it's January, we're fed up and we're lonely and we miss each other. So we had a wonderful festival called Kin where people could bring content, there were open mic sessions, there were headline speakers, there were boot camps. We created Kin Land, a sort of Miro style land you could enter where you could put down your favorite podcast, one of yours would be in there now, a library of resources, a place to do workshops. So Kin Land and Kin is another way to say, how does a disparate community, we're fluid all over the world, from Asia through to Europe, from Istanbul to Dubai, how can people come together to have conversations and to create content live? So that was Kin, we've done the Kin Graph. And one of the other things that we're looking at is our communities, because what's happened, interestingly for us through COVID, that you couldn't necessarily have predicted, is that the upside is that communities were able to form very quickly through Zoom. But across the collective, community groups started to form around climate, around circular, around sustainable mobility, around the future of health, around the future of work. So now you can actually, if you came to Q and you said, I'm not so interested in connecting with a company, but I am interested to see what your firepower is in the circular economy. And you could come into Q and find that whole community and tap into that community, which is vibrant, they're publishing, they're writing, they're pitching clients. So that's another thing that I'm very interested in taking further is how does a collective of companies become a community of communities where micro communities spring up, swarm, do their thing, and then disperse. So those are just a few of the things I do on a daily basis. One is idea spotting. One is in the territory of acquisitions and venturing, and one is in the central services and products that Q might make in order to help our member companies go further.
I like the way you first expressed it to me with your own descriptors, you know, finding the rebels, but then you gave me the sort of corporate scenario titles. The acquisitions. It's great. And I get it. You told me in an earlier conversation that the universe finds people. You don't find the job. The universe finds you. Tell me how the universe brought you to Michael and this company. I didn't realize how young it is. And this collective, as you refer to it, how did they find you? How'd the universe find you?
Well, as I said to you the very first time we spoke, a very important VVIP, high platform, can't say that person's name, did once say to me, Farah, eventually the universe will speak to you. I had gone through a series of transitional phases, and she, very awesome lady, said to me, Farah, one day the universe will speak to you, so just make sure you're listening. And I remember saying, how do I schedule that in, that moment when the universe will speak to me? So I'm certain to be awake, because otherwise, you know, what if I sleepwalk through that day and I missed it? Anyway, so there was that sense of something will speak to you, you just have to be in the ready position. You know, it's the old Louis Pasteur quote, chance favors the prepared mind. And I think I came to a time as I finished my epic 3 years at Girl Effect with the Nike Foundation. I'd had a life-altering 3 years, actually taking my skills from the private sector into the not-for-profit global philanthropy aimed at girls and aimed at how do you use media and brands and data and mobile to disrupt systems of poverty, you know, intergenerational, ingrained poverty. And what are the modern techniques now to give women and girls in marginalized communities around the world? How do you give them voice and visibility and value? So sort of coming off a really, I would say, big learning experience for me. And I think I was the most awake I've ever been in my life. And then, you know, it's serendipity, isn't it? And people find people. I had an offer to work for another company, a sort of big corporate job. It was going to be based stateside. And I remember ringing my friend Keith Yamashita, who's the co-founder of SY Partners, a colleague at Q, and had been, in fact, Keith and I had worked together because I'd been his client at Girl Effect. And I remember calling Keith and saying, so I've got this big, monstrously huge, life-changing job offer on the table. The legal contracts have been drawn up, we're all ready to rock. I'm set to sign, I'm going to be famous. Everybody's going to think, oh my God, she scored a great job. Why do I feel nothing? Why do I feel like, actually, I don't know if I even want to get out of bed for this. I'm meant to like this job, aren't I? And Keith was the one who said, it's possible that your eyes have been opened to purpose-driven creativity in a way that means you can't go back. You have to come forward. Why don't you think about Q? And I knew Michael. I mean, the irony of it is that Michael and I have been great friends for, you know, the best part of 15 years. I knew him when he was at Omnicom. I was at BBDO. He was obviously already super important, highly regarded executive at Omnicom. And I was a sort of rookie coming up through the ranks. But I think he'd sort of adopted me, and we'd become great friends after we both left. And he called me and we got into a conversation that felt like I was going forwards into something new rather than backwards into something I could be assured of. So it was backwards to something I could do with my eyes shut, or forwards into something I would have to have my eyes wide open for. Yeah.
It sounds like he almost created that position for you to walk into.
Well, I think it's a tribute to Michael that he was, it was some creative thinking required. It was an inaugural role. It didn't exist. He knew me. I knew him. I understood enough about the Q Collective. And we worked on, you know, what would be a good way to bring me in? How could I actually add value? It was a new role, so it would be augmentative to Q. And also at a time where Q itself was turning 4 or 5. So it was also to say this could now coincide with the next chapter of Q. The first phase that Michael and the team, Keith, Susan, Tim, they'd created this assemblage. And now the second stage was having assembled. I remember Michael saying, now maybe we need an unleashing. And I can't think of anyone who might be a better agent of unleashing than you. Yeah, so tribute to him that he spotted me as an idea and unleashed me.
For my podcast listeners who must go back and listen to the episode with Andy Bateman, who is the CEO of the US HQ for Sidley, one of the companies in this collective under Q. And it was funny, we were talking about creative Venn diagrams, and I mentioned the Ikigai, which is a Venn diagram.
I know Ikigai, yes.
Yes, and it's all about purpose, and that's a Japanese word. And it's also very cultural, right? That there's different circles that overlap, and in the center, we find our purpose, which I live by. I'm very mix of Western and Eastern philosophies and psychologies. And he said, by the way, did you know that this company is with a Japanese holding firm? And so that's when I did a deep dive into Q and I found you. And, you know, on the daily, I wonder, what is my purpose? And I think one of the purposes that I serve is that I am a good connector and a conduit to others in the space. And I hope to encourage, I hope to engage, enlighten, and entertain. I'm extraordinarily excited that I got to speak with Farah Ramzan Golant of the Q Collective and that I get to share her story. And I know that everything she said will be a kernel of gold. So not only will you listen, but you'll listen again and again.
I mean, we're very mindful and actually loving of our Japanese affiliation, because you mentioned Ikigai, which is a beautiful word and a beautiful purpose statement. But I found around Ikigai, those four circles, they have actually become a compass for me personally and professionally, because if you remember the four circles with Ikigai in the middle, the first circle is doing what you love.
Right.
The second circle is doing what you're good at, and what you love and what you're good at, not always the same thing. Doing what you love, doing what you're good at, doing what the world needs, and doing what you can get paid for.
That's right.
So in those four interlocking circles, love, good at, need, and can get paid for, that for me is a remarkably simple but profound way of navigating our decision making. Is this the right client? Is this the right company? Is this the right moment? That Ikigai is actually incredible. Yeah, yeah.
It's funny that you say that, because that's exactly how I have moved my company. Passion to power, that's the basis and the mantra. And it's funny because I didn't know about Ikigai when I started my platform, but it made total sense to me. And I've worked in Japan and I learned a little bit of business Japanese because I was a sensei there. And then I was a choreographer with NHK TV and I worked with artists. And in some part of Tokyo, it's a very imitative society. You know, they're very imitative of Western culture. But when you embrace their traditional ancient thoughts.
Yes, yes.
It somehow is so relevant and resonant to today.
Well, I agree totally. And though I've told you the story of Michael and Keith finding a way to seduce and encourage me to come to Q, the truth is that I also fell in love with Q, not Michael or Keith, but Q the concept, in a modern art gallery in Tokyo. I'd flown to Tokyo with Michael to meet our shareholders, the head of our holding company, an amazingly mesmeric and wise man called Toda-san, who is the CEO of HDY Holdings, but hails from a creative background, not a financial one, which I think speaks for itself. Is a beautiful storyteller and beautifully why he intuits everything. And I'd gone to meet him and I was having a formalish interview through interpreters and, you know, and I was kind of, this is quite nice and he seems lovely and I haven't done anything wrong yet. And then sort of halfway through the interview, he sort of paused and said, okay, well, this has been lovely. And I thought, oh no, he's terminating our interview. And he said, this has been lovely, but I think we should continue the discussion somewhere else. And I thought, oh, we're going to move into another room. And he said, no, somewhere else. I'm going to take you to a modern art gallery, not far away. And I think we should walk through the art gallery and continue talking. So the second half of my interview was Toda-san and the interpreter Michael Birkin and I walking through a modern art gallery with a like outstanding art that in itself was, I was talking to a man with ancient wisdom in a modern art gallery, at the end of which I sort of felt, I think I'm feeling love. Yeah.
Oh, that's an amazing story. Yeah, that for me was the great dichotomy of Tokyo, the ancient and the completely modern. And yeah, of course, this was pre-pandemic when it was millions of people per square inch, you know, running around. And it was profound, confounding, everything, you know, my experience there and being a gaijin, you know, with blonde hair at the time. Also feeling like an outsider. I had never really felt that sense of looking so different, which of course is a great little segue for us about diversity and inclusion, which is a very important topic. And I think you'll probably be the queen bee to talk about this with all the incredible diversity in not only your own life and family and DNA, but also in the diversity of the collective. Can you speak to that? Because it seems to be an incredibly important mandate right now.
Well, you know, it's been important for always. It's just a series of awakenings we've had. And I think its importance is very well understood now. There has been a series of earthquakes in the diversity and inclusion discussion. And I think why it matters so much, apart from all the things we already know, the inequities, the injustices, et cetera, systemic forms of exclusion. I think it's important because I think it's the only way for businesses and society to grow in a way that's resilient and real. And because until you have diversity of perspective in the workplace, in the creative mindset, around boardroom tables, I can't tell you how many boards I have sat on. I mean, the first board I ever joined when I was 40, just turned 40 and was a CEO. In that time now, in the last 17 years, how the composition of boards have changed. When I turned up, I was a sort of novelty, you know, here I am, youngish, ethnic, you know, multilingual kind of curiosity. And what I know, what we all know to be true is, until it is part of the current, the main current, not just a sort of must have, until it's part of the main current, we can't build our world, we can't build society, we can't build brands, we can't build communities, we can't even build buildings. We can do nothing that's resilient and growth orientated until we open our eyes to the mandate and start to take, in my view now, a series of quick experiments. Let's quit the talking and do some doing. Let's make stuff rather than talk about making stuff. What happens when you open that door and enable people to pass through a doorway marked hope?
We hear so much, and it often feels like PR, about big corporations doing good, you know, and, you know, just from a very skeptical standpoint about the tax benefits of doing good. And that's often the incentive. So it is very heartwarming to hear when a big company is actually making activations on behalf of real change in the world.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, look, I'm British. You don't get more skeptical than the British. And actually, even many years later now, I've just finished last week some very intensive, but very eye-opening judging on the Cannes Lion jury. I was on the jury for Glass, which is, you know, Glass for Good and for gender equity, diversity and inclusion, et cetera. And I have to tell you, Michelle, I was absolutely blown away by the caliber and audacity of some of the ideas that have come through a COVID world. I mean, they've all been announced now, but case studies of creativity from all over the world, from Brazil to the States, from Russia to England, there was a sort of unabashed audacity in how do you construct activations for change. And in the judging, I mean, there was a, you know, really lovely jury. anything that looked like it was an expedient jump on International Women's Day, or jump on this, or do it because it's going to buy you more customers, or do it because it's going to tick a corporate social responsibility metric, you could see that from a mile away and could discount that. And the ones that made it through to the prize winners, the Grand Prix and the golds and the silvers, were ones where you literally thought these brands have embraced the notion of sustained change, have written it into the DNA of their brand, and have written it into the DNA of their business strategy. So not only my experience at Girl Effect, but, you know, just recently, there are companies all over the world now. And I think in a way, COVID has accelerated something that was already coming.
We were going to go and get into this, right, about how COVID has changed and has there been a silver lining. So let's tell me about how you think COVID has enabled some new lines of creativity and opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to be said, though we all know it, but it should be said, that there's been unbelievable suffering and setback through COVID. So when I talk about the upside, I think it's worth noting, I say this intentionally knowing that people have suffered incredible and in some cases irreversible setbacks. But what I have seen through this time, both in the way that Q has turned, how many companies in the world have turned, how creative people have risen, is that I think it's brought to the fore and accelerated patterns that were emerging pre-COVID. And those patterns were the world thinking about collaboration differently, about connective tissue differently, about, wait, is this about competition or is this about an unlikely collaboration? And I think those thoughts were in the sort of collective world of business and creativity. And I think what COVID did is it forced us to stop and say, I mean, we literally all level set, everybody had to stop and say, ask only one question apart from, you know, are we safe and will we survive? You could only ask one question, is what matters now? Literally, what matters now, in a way that it just cuts away through all the noise and the politics and the dysfunction of the systems in our world. And I think what creative people did was they embraced ambiguity, and they embraced it the way that creative people and creative companies do. They stepped into the void and into the breach, what matters now, and opened up a series of, well, we can collaborate differently. We can rise to a different systemic challenge. If I think about the work that Q did, for instance, related to COVID, vaccine hesitancy, you know, in our health convening space, I mean, our health community of practice just went gangbusters and found a way to collaborate, to get out into the world in front of clients, to think about, what are the big questions that we need to hold? What are the systems that are changing? So I think it got people to think about collaboration. I think it got people to think about what happens when you build bridges, literally. Let's not build walls, let's build bridges, and how quickly people could build bridges. And then I think it made people also understand that creative people are able to stand up to some of the most intractable challenges if they come at it with the right mindset. Multifaceted, multidisciplined, open minds, diverse capabilities. And the other thing I think I saw Q do and many companies is that we embraced polarities. You know, when there's a tension, people always say, oh, well, we've got to resolve this tension. You know, we've got to get to the bottom of this. And we go, no, actually, we have to embrace those polarities. The difference between a long arc of the future and the gritty reality of now, the difference between what individual people need in the workplace versus the whole of society trying to get back to work, the difference between little experiments to see if we can get things moving to tectonic shifts. Those polarities, we just held them open, explored them, and worked through them. And I think that's been a great strength. Yeah.
So is there a secret sauce to the rebels that you find, who find you, in terms of the collective companies? Of course, I did a deep dive into all of them, and just incredible thinkers, people. So, you know, they use that term in the box, and I never got it because I always lived in sort of a circular world of, moving around and around. And maybe that's a women thing too. You know, we go around and around. But what's the secret sauce to become part of Q?
Well, I think it isn't actually a secret. It's just a really simple set of beliefs. To join Q as a company or a person, a human being, I think you have to really believe in the power of creativity to change things. And you have to have a very high standard of what creativity looks like. So, you know, you have to kind of be best in class, and you have to be prepared to push the boundaries. So not just be top tier, but say, how do we raise the ceiling? How do we raise the floor? How do we actually just change the way it looks? I also think, you know, you have to kind of believe in the power of collaboration. You can't be a part of a collective if there's no reciprocity, if there's no trust, if there's no sense of belonging. People who join the collective, companies who join the collective, so recently Godfrey Dadich joined last year, Public Digital joined. I think these are companies who have a really strong culture and a really strong set of rituals in their discipline, a really strong sense of self. And the companies that do best are the ones that don't say, oh, what can Q do for us? How will you invest in us? And how will you, you know, put some firepower? I think the companies that do really well are the ones that say, what can we do for Q? How can we rewrite your DNA? How can we upload our perspectives to make you more stretchy and multifaceted, more muscular? So it's companies who want to give as much as take. Obviously, we invest, we work really hard to earn the trust of companies. But once they're in the collective, we don't run their businesses, they run their businesses. Most of the companies who join come with their founders, come with their management teams. We have a strong belief that you run your business, you have high autonomy, high self-definition. And then what do you want of yourself and your DNA to become part of the Q?
What people want to know is, how do you end up being here? And you talked about bridges. Well, I use those analogies all the time, building one stone at a time and having a stone bridge. And then how do you get from that stone and land on this stone? So those who are aspiring to all the different types of initiatives that your collective covers, television and film, branding, commercials, digital, architecture. I mean, there's just a multitude, right? What would you say to yourself reflecting back now from what you know that could help our listeners in that 18 to 26 pod?
Yeah, what a beautiful question. I guess what I would say is, and I also put this in the context of how I was back in the day and the things that I was sort of fixated on. And I think what I would say to the younger group that you've just described is two things. The quote that's just jumped into my mind is that Howard Thurman quote, that don't ask what the world needs, ask what brings you alive and go do it, because the world needs people who have come alive. So to that younger age group, I would say, you know, think about what brings you alive. Move away from notions of this is kind of the path, and this is what success looks like, and this is what failure looks like, and actually just go into your inner space and say, what brings me alive? Because I know in the end, my path will be best trodden when I am fully alive and fully awake. I will be able to do a better job, be seen, be more heard, be more rewarded, rise in the places that I should rise in. So I think it's this notion of do the work you need to do, which I didn't do early enough, to understand what brings you alive, and then go do it, because people will see it and feel it. That's the first thing. And then the second thing that I think is to not be fixated with this notion of failure and success. I mean, I know that, you know, we're taught, as was I, that, you know, success, and you've got to perform, you know, it's about your performance and your success, and it doesn't matter if you have a failure because you'll learn from your failure, and actually in real life failure hurts and it leaves scar tissue, and you go, and I can't even share my vulnerability because I'm meant to say I've learned from that failure. All of that I think is slightly outdated. I think it's less about failure and success and more about courage. The courage to, you know, what's that? I don't want to give you too many quotes, but what's that? And since I'm in Britain, I might give you Winston Churchill when he said, you know, success is not final. Failure is not fatal. It's the courage to continue that counts. So it's to think about what brings you alive and then try to apply your maximum courage to your pathway. I think there is no substitute to hard work. I mean, I'm, you know, maybe my immigrant past, maybe because, you know, I started at a company when I was 24 and went all the way to CEO when I was 39. I worked really hard, and don't underestimate the power of friendship. You know, friends will be there to provoke you, to support you, to help you when you get knocked down, to not give you bullshit lines like, don't worry about that failure, it will be fine. And actually it won't be fine, and this is devastating and I'm crying with you, would have been helpful. So I think I would say that to that younger segment, and to the second segment, you know, I think we also need to think as we become more mature, more experienced, about the notion of, you know, what's fixed and what's fluid. Because things get fixed, don't they? The older you get, you did or didn't have a life partner, you did or didn't have children, you did or didn't choose an industry that embraced you and let you rise. So some things do get fixed. And you have the impression, little by little, that options get eliminated because, you know, your path became more fixed. I would say to hear the undercurrents of fluid, even as things get fixed. There is a fluidity in the world now, are enabled by technology, enabled by data, enabled by human beings just wanting lust for travel. I cannot wait to get back to Tokyo, cannot wait to get back to Istanbul. Not just geographical travel, but the kind of mindset that says, how do we find new cultures? IDEO just set up a beautiful IDEO.org studio in Nairobi. I can't wait to be back in Nairobi in a not-for-profit studio. So I think it's to understand we are supported by fluid currents, and what seems fixed now is supported by fluid currents, and the currents open options rather than close them. And not to be too fixated on you know, success. You know, I think the question that I would ask myself in this age bracket is, actually it's less about success and more about significance. You know, your successes will be forgotten. Nobody will care. You'll barely care about your own successes in the fullness of time, but you will have a sense of the significance of your impact and your footprint and the people that you touched, and the people who will think, oh, because of working with you, I think I was enabled to fly a bit further. I believed in myself more, I went a little bit further. So I think less about success and more about significance.
Listen, we have had an incredible conversation, and I would love for you to just close by adding anything that you feel you've left out that you might want to add to your story.
I feel the instinct to leave you with this real strong sense I have of a moment of mobilization now, that I just think the world, companies, brands, human beings, we've come to a point of inflection, everybody in different places and different stages. So I guess my thing is a call to action. You know, what can we do to mobilize now for change, for good, for the things that we believe in? How can we make stuff, not talk about making stuff? And how can we do stuff rather than intend to do stuff? So it's all, how do we mobilize now and find our superpowers and change the world as we come through this period? It's, we've had, you know, an incredible time of reckoning. Now, history will look back and say, what did this world do in the wake of COVID and who mobilized and who actually stepped out of their comfort zone, embraced ambiguity, just had a go. So I guess my call to action is have a go, embrace ambiguity, have a go.